Welcome to the Home Stretch Podcast, where we talk to star athletes, medalists, coaches, people who have achieved world-class status in the sport of track and field, and we talk to them about their journey and their struggles and how they got to the level of success that they did. Because I'll tell you what, everybody has a story of trials that they had to overcome, because life is not easy, and if you want to be successful, you have to endure, and you have to push through, and you have to work hard. So today, I want to welcome my guest, Kamika Bingham from Canada. And also, we also want to welcome my co-host, Ashley Kelly, joining me again today. How you doing, Ashley?
I'm doing good, Adrian.
Wonderful.
Kamika, thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming. I can't do this by myself. I just talk too much.
I know, same.
Cut me off. So welcome, Kamika. Nice to meet you. Join us from Canada. And you are a two-time Pan Am game medalist, a silver and a bronze, and also known as Canada's fastest woman. Because it was a blazing time of 11:13 in 100 meters. That was it, right? 11:13?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep, yeah, you got it right.
You would smoke a lot of folks out there, guys. Yes. If you're wondering, you would get beaten. So I don't care what football you play. Anyway, thanks for coming. I want to hear about your journey, you know, coming up in Canada. I know Canada has somehow a lot of sprinters. It's cold up there, but you guys have a lot of sprinters, and I guess it's a tradition up there. So tell me about coming up in Canada, running track, why track, and whatever, just however way you want to go with it.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Canada. I think there is a lot of sprinters just because a lot of our parents are immigrants from like the Caribbean and all over places and stuff. So for me, like, my dad did track, my mom knows track. So that was something that they kind of knew. And then like before I even did track, they put me in gymnastics because we were a very sports oriented family. But yeah, I think it's just like the Caribbean influence a little bit, you know, a lot of us, we have parents of Caribbean descent.
Mm-hmm. So. And where are you repping? What Caribbean island are you repping?
Jamaica all day, every day.
Oh man, we just exposed Canada's secret. They have all Jamaicans up there running the show. Okay, so now I get what's going on. Even though it's a little cold, y'all still have some sprints going on over there. So you said you did which sport when you were younger? Was that gymnastics?
Yeah, I did gymnastics. I started when I was 8. Okay. I quit when I was 14. And like that was supposed to be like my Olympic dream. Like that was supposed to be my Olympic sport, the thing that I took all the way. But my parents had to take me out for financial reasons. Oh. So at the time, both of my older siblings, I have an older brother and a sister, and they were both in university. So I was a national level gymnast, but like covering my gymnastics fees and then their tuition. My parents were like, they sacrificed so much just to make sure that, you know, their kids didn't have to take out loans, that they would get an education, they would excel. So my parents were actually like cleaning the gym to try to reduce my gymnastics fee. And I didn't know that for years, but they would secretly leave the house, go clean the gym to try to reduce like my fees. And one day they got a letter from who was my coach, but also like the boss, that, It was a really nasty letter. Like it said pretty much, you know, single mothers can pay for their kids' gymnastics fees and, you know, you guys are behind. So, you know, my mom, she's a Jamaican mom. Like she does not take well to that. So no. I felt like that was a hard pill for them to swallow. They felt disrespected. They were really upset about it. And at that time, like my heart was really transitioning out of gymnastics anyways. Like I, at that point, wanted to pursue track. So when they told me like, yeah, we're going to pull you out, I was okay. Like I already knew my plan B was track.
And you know,
and what was your track career like?
I didn't really have a track career before then. Like I think grade 6 track and field day at school, like that was, I guess, like the most like introduction that I've had. And then because I was a gymnast, I was the smallest out of everybody. And you know, I just remember like I just raced 100 meters and I won. And I just remember that feeling of winning. And I don't know, it just carried with me. Like I loved racing. I'll be barefoot on the sidewalk, race anybody any day. So, yeah, like I didn't have a track career. It was just more of like the influence came from my dad because he had a little bit of track background. But it was just something that I just knew I loved to run. And when I was a gymnast, I was a power gymnast. Like, I wasn't graceful. So, you know, I was, you know, on the vault, on the floor, like, I was a power gymnast. If you know gymnasts now, like Simone Biles, where they're powerful, like, that was me. So I just knew that I wanted to sprint.
So you make an interesting point. I always love to go back to this about track and field as a sport and how much opportunity it provides. So you had mm-hmm. to get out of gymnastics because of a financial barrier. Mm-hmm. Even though your parents were sacrificing and they were out there cleaning up so that you had that opportunity, you still had to leave the sport because it was a financial burden. And mm-hmm. I would say this about track and field, and especially when it comes to the universities here in the U.S. that are cutting track. Track provides opportunity. All you need are your feet. You know, in some place you could run. I mean, I've been to Grenada. You know, you see grass tracks, Ashley, I'm sure.
You know, we started on a grass track and a gravel track.
Exactly. So
rubber and red tracks was a thing of imagination. If we made a major games, that's when we saw a rubber track. But I grew up on a grass track.
Exactly. And so, mm-hmm. you know, you have an opportunity for me. It was an opportunity to come to the U.S., to go to school, to get a scholarship. And it's, you know, I'm a track coach. So my whole life has been track. And, you know, that's significant. And so, you know, because it isn't a sport where you have to be able to pay for a whole bunch of rackets and clubs and you know, or, you know, the expensive sport, the money sports, you know, you have an opportunity to come out here and become a medalist and a champion. And it kind of creates a new path in life for you. So, no, I just wanted to call that out because that's, you know, track is an opportunity sport for sure.
It is.
I like to hear that. Yeah. So you were a gymnast. So you're also an Olympian. You were in the 2016 games.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to fast forward too much, but did you get to meet Simone? Because I did. You did it?
I didn't meet her. I saw her. So I saw all of them, like Gabby, Allie Raisman.
You didn't get anything like... I got a selfie.
No, I would see them in the cafeteria, but I was just one of those people where I didn't want to like bombard people. You know, like it was more of like, okay, I saw you. I know your stories. And that's it.
I'm going to tell y'all, this is honest. I was starstruck when I saw her and I was so nervous to go because I was like, I'm going to go talk to her and get a selfie with her. Cause she was in the cafeteria, you know, it's the cafeteria. So I'm like, oh, that's Simone Biles. And she's, you know, like this tall. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go over there. And I'm like building up the courage. Like, all right. Okay. I'm gonna go over there. Hey, can I take a selfie with you? And she smiled and took the selfie. And I was really excited. So, that's me just, you know, Olympic Village just nerding out, but man, you didn't get to take a picture with her.
No, I know. I guess it's just it's an athlete thing. Like I just don't like to bother people.
I had no
pride. I was just gonna say that it's an athlete thing because I saw Serena, I saw Paul Pierce in the cafeteria, and I was just like, you know what? I'm an athlete. You're an athlete. You know, I ain't going to get attacked
by so many people. Uh-huh. So I'm
guess
like...
what though? I have a selfie with Simone now.
Well, we ate 5 feet or 10 feet away from them. It's okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I don't want to get too far ahead in your career because the Canadian system is different because in the U.S., you know, we really had that universe, that NCAA D1, you know, university mm-hmm. system. Did you go to school in the U.S. or did you stay in Canada and just compete?
Yeah, I stayed in Canada.
So that's different. You really, it is. You know. The U.S. is like the breeding grounds. You know, everyone from all over the world sends their athletes to college in the U.S. So tell me about that journey, because it's different.
Yeah, I was the black sheep. Really? Everybody that went before me, they all were going to school on scholarship. For me, I feel like the only reason why I stayed was, well, one, I got government funding, which is called carding. And carding, yeah.
Oh, so pretty early you were put on a training grant and they saw you, they identified your talent.
Yeah.
Well, you were.
So, yes, when I was in grade 12, coming out of high school, I received carding. And with that, they would pay for your tuition to go to school.
What kind of times were you running in high school?
My personal best was 11:46.
Oh, you was a beast. Oh, so you were smoking, folks. Okay,
yeah, and then 23:04. So I was highly recruited. So there was a lot of schools that were like looking at me, but my parents.
Which school came after you the hardest?
Texas Christian. Texas Christian. Oh, yeah, TCU. Okay. Yeah, TCU was definitely like phone calls. Nice. All consistently was like, yeah, really, really pushing me. There was like Nebraska, like there was some schools, but I feel like I already kind of knew that I was going to stay. And I knew that if I took a visit, I probably would have changed my mind. So yeah. It was good that I never took a visit because I was going to take a visit.
Those college visits will get you, especially when you're talking to a Power Five, you'll be like, oh my, I'm not leaving. I'm staying here. So what factor, made you decide that you weren't going to go to NCAA Ryan, that you were going to stay in Canada?
I was trying to think really like longevity and the years, like the few girls that I had competed with that were older than me that had gone away to school, besides like the Andre DeGrasse, like some of the guys that really thrived, a lot of the girls came back and they were completely done with the sport. They were broken, like a lot of them really struggled with that system. And so my parents were like, this system is working for you. If it's not broken, then why fix it? You can stay here, have your tuition paid for, stay with the coach that, works for you. And I think for me, it was more of having that luxury of having control over what I wanted to do, over having control over my career. Because, when you're over there, it's like you're on scholarship. It's like you're going to run. I tell you to run, like
for that money.
Yeah,
you have to score points.
Hey, you better score a point in conference.
Yeah, yes. Better score a point of conference.
Hey, listen,
or else your scholarship is going to get taken.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a double-edged sword.
It is.
I think because it is a breeding ground for champions. It's super competitive, and you're going to compete against the best every weekend. But then there's also the other side where you're going to get run into the ground at some places. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of Caribbean. I feel bad about it because I know that coming to the U.S. for a lot of folks, you get the opportunity to come to a big university and you get a really good degree. That's going to change your future. But I know a lot of folks in the Caribbean kind of are they're really apprehensive about sending their athletes to the U.S. because they've seen the kids who've disappeared, who've been running to the ground and their careers have been cut short. So, it's a tough decision. Yeah, you can stay home and train there. And also, I think there's a piece of when it comes to being someone like you who runs on a national team, there's a piece of, the country liking to have you there and representing there, not running off to the U.S. or some other country.
Yeah, so that's exactly what happened to me. So my national, the federation was doing the absolute most to try to keep me here. They're like, okay, we're going to support you. We're going to make sure that you have this because all of the athletes that left, they were like, oh, something happened. Sorry. There was no support for them when they were coming back. Like, don't get injured now because they were not going to help you. So I felt like they really lended out that extra hand just to make sure, like, we will support you through this if you stay. And they've kind of changed that system now because they realized that the athletes that did go to the school, the states that, prospered through that system were doing really, really well. So they were like, okay, well, we just have to support it. So they came around. But I know for me, they were highly advocate for me to stay and they're really happy for me to stay. So for me, it was like a what if at that time, what if I went, what would have happened and stuff like that. But interesting enough, like the only school that I would have wanted to go to was LSU. And then,
come on, man, get out of here.
Yeah. And then like, so at 17, 18,
I'm not trying to be a hater,
I didn't get
so
to go, but I ended up going when I was 23. So it's kind of, I don't know, life kind of works out different. Interesting.
Yeah, Adrian is a USC alum, so SEC
subject
for him.
Really?
Hey, I'm not gonna let me just say I'm gonna say one thing, and I don't care who gets mad. I don't remember what year it is. I work at Cornell, we're Ivy League, and we beat them about 4-1 year. So I think it was like
wow. Okay, well that's a 4x4, but
Now that you're training. Yeah. Now that you're training at LSU, do you ever think back and say like, okay, I might have changed my mind? Now did you see it in hindsight?
Oh, so you're training at LSU now.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm training there now. No, because I think the Kamika that I am now versus the Kamika at 17, 18, I don't know if I would have handled it pretty well. Like, I was a very naive, very gullible. And that was the thing that my parents were like really concerned about too. Like, you're going to just be sent off to some different country. You know, you're gullible, you're not, like, I don't know. There was just, I just wasn't mature enough. And I don't think I would have handled that system really at the time. I don't know. But I think that me coming down here at 23, it was like more on like business. And I just felt like I could have been lost getting distracted in terms of like football games and everything's big and everything's new. And, you know, Canada is, it's not sports oriented. It's not as big. Everything's very small community type. So, you know, I would have been starstruck and probably lost focus. And who knows if I still would be doing track right now. So I think everything happens for a reason, and I needed to meet certain people to like shape my life. So, happy to be there now, but I don't know how it would have been if I came down here like fresh out of high school.
So fresh out of high school, you're running 11.4 and you're getting ready to go to York University. What was that journey like going from 11.4 to 11.1, and what did it take to get to that level?
I mean, I was training with the National Training Center, which is technically called the Hub now. And I don't know, like that was kind of like, it was like an elite group. Like that was the it group in Canada. So all the ones that either went away to school, came back, or the ones that stayed, like that was, you know, that elite group. So like you had to get selected basically to be in that group. Like not anybody can just be in there. So I felt like that was almost like an NCAA setting for us. Like it was very competitive in practice every single day. I had Crystal, Kim, Shot, like, there was so many girls around me that I was always competitive in practice. And I felt like I needed that in order for me to get better. Cause like when I was in a club running 11.4, I was running by myself, you know, but when you have competition all the time in practice, I think it pushes you to the next level, which is why I was like, well, I got to go to the States, get my butt kicked a little bit. You know, these girls are running 10.9, 10.8. And, you know, you just have to be in a competitive environment in order to grow.
I think we're going to go ahead. That's going to be a little teaching thing right there, folks. Pay attention. It's because that transcends track and field. OK, anything that you want to get better at, you need to put yourself in a competitive environment. You know, you have to be able to, you have to compete. It hones your senses, sharpens your skills, reinforces your motivation. It makes you better. So you want to be better, put yourself around some people who are the best and fight for it.
Yeah. I also think that you should always be in groups that you emulate someone. Like you shouldn't be in the group where you're the best ever, because then you have nothing to strive for. There should always be someone around you that you're like, okay, I have to get her today. Or like in the track setting, like I have to get her today or she's not getting me today. And you always have that mindset that you are trying to push yourself past a certain limit each day. And that's, I think that's also important outside of track, in the corporate world and in the boardroom. It helps every day.
Absolutely.
No, and you made another valid point. You know, folks overlook that. When you're 16, 17, going to college, and, you know, you're going from living with your parents and they're cooking your meals and you're in the house with them to pretty much being able to eat when you want, what you want, stay out. You can sleep outside if you want to. No one's going to tell you anything. You can skip every class if you choose to. No one's going to stop you until that GPA comes out and you're not eligible. Like, but you have so much more freedom to mess up. And obviously, you know, making mistakes is part of growth, but it can be overwhelming when you're tossed into a completely different situation like that for younger kids, especially if you're acknowledging, hey, I wasn't so mature, you know, that might've been. Whereas now as an adult, as a professional, you're like, I'm about my money. I'm coming out here so I can run 10.7 and that's all it's about for me. So you're not going to be thinking about, oh, I'm going to be up late partying and doing this. Because the college days are done. So it's like, so it does make sense finding the best, most competitive place now for you at this point in your career.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your teammates, Shai, Kim, and Crystal. I know those were the same ladies that you went to World Relays with.
Well, and you had to compete each day. Let's get full names for non-track folks.
Of course. So Kim Hyacin, Crystal Emmanuel, and Shai help me out with Shai's last name.
Davis.
Shai Davis. And they were the 4x1 relay members that went to the World Relays in 2015. So talk about that experience and how did that go?
So we went, I think our best year was the 2015 year, and that was fresh off of losing Dondre. And I think we just had like a completely different, like, I think that whole experience, we became closer. Like, I think our bonds just became better because we all had to be there for each other. We were all mourning and, you know, we made it our motto, our mission to always just finish strong. So yeah, we left it out on the track. We knew like that was the opportunity for us to book a ticket for Team Canada to have a relay team in Rio and anchored the women's relay. It was a very close finish. We just got fourth by 1/100 of a second. But for us to like book that ticket, that was the biggest thing. And at the time, that was the Canadian record for us. So like that was the fastest we've ever ran, which we were really happy about. But, you know, yeah.
You mentioned DeAndre. I know you and him were really close. Talk about that scenario and what actually happened. Could you just quickly went over it for people who don't know?
So DeAndre, he is like 6'2". He is also Jamaican. So he's a Jamaican athlete, but he actually represents Canada. So he was born in Jamaica, came to Canada, and he also went to like the Mississippi. He went to Mississippi State for university. But yeah, we were just like, he was like my close friend. Like he was like, that brother sister type of relationship. I always knew that like he had my back, but we had that, like, we always like play fought. Like we were always teasing each other. I would get on his nerves and that was just like our relationship. And, so because Canada's cold, we can't train outside. We can't really, you know, it's not beneficial for us to be indoors. We always took trips to St. Kitts. And Dondre loved St. Kitts because it's the islands. Like this is like, that's where he loved to be. It's like almost like home for him. And so he asked me, you know, like I asked him actually just to like go down to the Patty place. And I was like, yeah, walk with me to the Patty place. And he came with me and we were just talking. We had like a good hour and a half talk. And afterwards, when we came back to the hotel, there is another hotel that has like a beach. And usually we go to the beach, you know, to like go just chill on the beach, you know, recover our legs. Salt water is like really helpful for recovery. And so he asked me to go to the beach. There was already some of our teammates that were over there. This was like after a long week of Friday. So we knew that we had the weekend off. I didn't want to go, but I was like, okay, fine, I'll go. And interesting enough, like we were talking about people who didn't know how to swim. So, you know, we mentioned two teammates that we were like, I don't know how they don't know how to swim. Like, you know, like we were just talking about it in terms of like, for me, I was like, that's the first thing. If I have kids, that's the first thing that they're going to learn. Cause I don't want nobody to push my kids in water and they're going to drown. Like I literally said this before going into the water in the beach. It was like a normal day. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. It was a very normal day. Like we were, there was no crazy waves or anything of that sort. We were like close to shore, just standing, riding the waves a little bit. And at the time I didn't even know that Dondre couldn't swim. That was the one thing, like we were talking about it, but he never actually mentioned to me that he couldn't swim. So because he's tall, he went out a little further and he was like, oh yeah, like I can still touch, you know, like come out a little further. And I can swim decently, you know, I could do like a little, you know, my parents, my mom put us in swimming lessons. So like I can swim definitely like to save my life, but I'm not nearly like an expert or anything. So for me, like the second you just say, yeah, come out, like I'm going. So I was about to go. And then I don't know, it was just this weird, like I just heard this whisper and it just said, stay. Like I've never heard it before. And so I was like, I don't know, I'm just going to stay. Cool. There was a gentleman, Gavin, that was sitting beside me and he was kind of right beside me, but he can't swim. So Dondre was like, Gavin, you know, come out, come out, come out. And he's like, nah, I can't swim. I'm not going out a little further. And then I don't know. It was just like, he was like floating. everybody looked fine. Everybody was just riding the waves a little bit. It was cool. And then he said, Gavin, help. So we're like, why would he call? Like, we're like, nah, you know, Dondre, he's a jokester. Like, he always tells jokes. He's always, you know, like, that's just his character. He always laughs about things and makes a joke of everything. So we're like, nah, like, he's just joking. He just wants Gavin to go pretend to save him because, you know, it's funny just to, like, kind of scare Gavin a bit so that he goes out further. And then he said, help, help. So then we knew, like, okay, yeah, no, he's actually scared. There's something really wrong. And it was just this, I don't know, the whole incident was just like, it's, I still can't wrap my head around it. So Kim had actually went out to swim to go get him because she's like the strongest swimmer. So we're like, okay, Kim's going to go. She's going to grab him, pull him back. Great. We'll be fine. But there was this really strong undercurrent that we didn't really know about. So Kim ended up coming back. And so like, we had to kind of actually, you know, go out and actually pull her through because she was swimming, but she wasn't going nowhere. And she started crying, like hysterically crying, like, what's going on? Like, where's Dondre? And, you know, he was just riding the waves backwards. Like, it was just care. Like, the undercurrent was just pulling him back. So we had called help for on the beach. We had me and Kim ran to go get our coaches and get help. And, you know, people came out to him. They had like the little fins, the little flipper things, and they came out. And when they were like surrounding him, he just went under and we couldn't find him. He was just missing for 4 hours. It was the weirdest experience. Like, that was, I think, the first time I've ever really lost anybody. And I think it just being him, like, and just being so close to him for so long, like, I picked him up every single day for practice, running jokes, like, that was just the normal. So I don't know, it was just so crazy to like lose him in that way. But it definitely helped my relationship with God. And when I look back, like, you know, he passed in the place that he loved most. Like, he loved St. Kitts, he loved the beach. So I think there's always something and there's some beauty in tragedies.
Mm-hmm. It's always something, it's always good to, you know, pick out the positive parts in it. And there's always a silver lining in mm-hmm. it. And you guys honored his name as you guys continue the track during that year. So talk about what type of legacy you guys wanted to leave for him that year.
Yeah, so I know I used to always clown him for his start because he never used to have a good start. He would try to act like he can, you know, hop with the sprinters and we're like, Dondre, no, like, you're not a starter. But his finish was like incredible. You know, he could be fourth, fifth place coming around for the last stretch for the 400 and then win. You know, like, that was just how strong his finish was. He was just that type of athlete. So, you know, we had this model just like finish like Barnaby in track, in the race of life, just finish stronger than you've ever started, just finish strong. So for me, like, I knew that in 2015, like, that was just like my goal in practice, to finish strong in my races, in just the race of life, and you know, whatever obstacle I'm facing at the time, just always push through and finish strong. It doesn't really matter about what happens in the beginning or the middle. It just matters about how you finish. So that's kind of the motto that carried us. And I think 2015 was, you know, a really good year for us, just keeping that in mind.
See, that was a strong story. When you, this year has been tough for all athletes, you know, with COVID and it's impacted training, competition, and just all aspects of our lives in general. But you've been able to keep training. So what is it, what's your competition schedule look like this year? What are the plans for this year? I know, Olympics, you know, I'm hoping the Olympics are going to happen, but then I'm hearing that rumors of it being postponed. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about that?
Again?
I mean, it was like some article that went out. It was like Japan is like whispering that, no, we can't do it. It's expensive. We can't do it. And then once that article went out, there were other articles saying that article wasn't true. So somebody got in trouble, I guess, for saying that. I feel like it was like, we can't host this. And then, no, you weren't supposed to tell everybody. So, you know, I'm hoping, I know, you know, a lot of you have worked so hard for this, you know, last year and now into this year. So how is that impacting your training and what are the plans so far?
Well, training has been we are training like the Olympics is on. You know, we kind of already set from the start that we were going to prepare for the Olympic Games, whether it happens or not. But either way, we weren't going to hold back in terms of our training on based off of allegations or what ifs. So, and competition has been very minimized, very different this year. So normally there's a lot of US meets across, you know, to compete indoors. I've been fortunate enough to compete at home in LSU for a few meets. And, you know, there was like Arkansas and stuff, and supposed to leave tomorrow to go to the New Balance Grand Prix, but it's been hard. I think there's been a lot of people that have been struggling to really find those meets to really like help contribute to their training. But I don't know, like as athletes, you always have to adjust and adapt. I think COVID and the pandemic quarantine last year just taught us that we have to adjust and adapt in so many different ways. So you just have to be kind of flexible. But for me, it's just more of like, okay, well, you got a lot to think about. I think quarantine, COVID made me think about, you know, you can't have one stream of income. You can't be dependent on just one thing. There's so like it, I felt like if that wasn't a wake up call for a lot of people,
get a side
then
hustle.
You missed it. You missed it. You missed the lesson.
So as you talk about multiple streams of income, in 2015, you ran 11:13. Mm-hmm. And you were deemed the fastest woman in Canada. And at that point, fastest woman in Canada, all the sponsorships, everything should have just been like falling in your lap because you technically would have been the face of track and field. And I remember just from knowing you, I know that from the sponsorship side, there were some things that you were eligible for or could have went for, and they just thought you weren't the right fit. So tell me about that experience. What were you going on? What were your thought process and dealing with a situation like that when you felt that you gave everything that you could have gave everything, and there was still something outside factors that have contributed to, you know, your what people think of as success?
Yeah, I think for me, when I was like excelling through track, I felt like I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me that were really marketed, you know, on magazine covers, on billboards, or just highly, you know, marketed or represented in like the media and in sponsorships. So for me, it was something that like I wanted to set out to do for myself, just so that, you know, a young Black boy, Black girl, especially with a darker complexion, can look and be like, wow, like I seen her there and I know that I can do that. So for me, like I knew like opportunities were not going to just fall in my lap. I think in our sport, you know, image is a big thing. And for me, like I just dealt with the fact that colorism definitely has a little bit of an impact there too. You know, like they'll be like, yeah, we have a Black person, but they could be of a lighter complexion, so we're going to go with that person. Like, it's not really accolades, you know? So for me, I knew, I was like, okay, I have to, my accolades has to be up here. Like, I have to set it up really high for somebody to say, yeah, we'll give it to her. So for 2015, like, I felt like I did that. And, you know, for me, like, to be able to say fastest woman in Canada, like that was something where I'm like, you can't take that away from me. You know, like I worked really hard to get here. So I was approached by a common like running magazine, and I've seen so many people. I've seen people that, you know, were not necessarily elite athletes that were on the covers and things like that. So I'm like, you know what? I'm like, I can be on this. Like, this could be my starting point. So they approached me to do just like an interview, and I was like, yeah, absolutely, I'll do it. And the gentleman said, you know, he knows the people that do the cover. And he's like, our campaign is fastest woman in Canada. So like, they should love you. And I'm like, yes, God, thank you. Finally, you know, like I'm going to see a dark skinned Black woman on the cover of this magazine. And, you know, he came back and he told me, yeah, sorry. Like I talked to them and for some reason they felt like you just didn't fit the look. They were going in a different direction. And I was devastated. I was like, I didn't even know how to respond. I was just, all right. Okay. and when I saw,
The Sorry, fastest I didn't woman in Canada look. Didn't fit the look for the fastest woman in Canada campaign.
No.
So you didn't look like the fastest woman in Canada is supposed to look?
I guess what, so I wonder how the fastest, I don't know, because when I saw the magazine come out, it was a white athlete and she was in a different event. And so I guess they were trying to say that she's the fastest in that event. So she's so
literally a sprint.
Was it a distance event?
Literally a sprint.
Yeah, it was
the definition of fast is a sprint.
If you're a 100-meter runner, you're the fastest. We didn't say the most endurance, fastest. That's messed up. See, people think stuff like that doesn't happen. You know, like I know there's often a colorism debate, and people think stuff like that doesn't happen, but you know, it does. It does. Like some, I don't know if it's a higher level decision or if it's an individual bias, like that person thinks, let's get someone lighter or someone white for this. That looks right. Maybe it's that person. Cause it just seemed like that makes no sense to me personally. Like, why wouldn't you be, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, it's hard because you see world, it so much in
better,
America.
Do better world on this colorism stuff, please. Thank you very much.
Yeah. We're trying to do better. I mean, I guess they are trying to do better in colorism because they do see more representation or quote unquote representation now that everyone and the Black Lives Matter and everything. But it's crazy to think how close it can hit and in different populations. So even in athletics, you see it and over across different countries.
I mean, for me, like, you know, when you're growing up, you always think when you're growing up, you're told like this dark skin, it's jokes like, oh, you black as this or this and that. You're like, so it's like, it's strange. And then personally, as a guy, I felt that diminished as I got older, like less of that. But the main thing that I did see is people were like afraid or nervous around me. Like I'm walking somewhere and someone's walking by, like it just feels like they're very nervous or afraid. And I always attributed that to me being not only black, but of a darker complexion. Like some reason they're like scared. Like I'm going to.
Yeah. Like, why? Yeah.
Raggedy purse. Like, come on, man. I don't want your purse. I want a BMW over here. I don't want you to like get out, you know, across the street. So it's very crazy. And, you know, for some people who say, well, it doesn't matter what people think. It matters when it's impacting the opportunities. The fastest woman in Canada didn't get to be in the campaign because of this. So that's serious. Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's definitely ridiculous. But do you think that any of that has changed as you've grown in your career?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think I just learned that not every place, like not everywhere is going to value you. And I learned that, you know, I couldn't use that experience and what they thought of me and, you know, change how I saw my value or my worth or what I saw in myself. So, you know, like a year later, I was able to shoot for the Hudson Bay, which is, you know, almost like a Macy's, almost like a Dillard's in America. And so they're a major company and they were the sponsor for the Olympic Village gear in Rio. So I was selected, you know, they wanted me to model the gear and I was surprised because I was on billboards. I was in the storefronts. Like I was across Canada. And for me, like that was kind of my, you know, like I was at that point, I was like, what's a magazine cover to this? Because I legit, you know, had young kids, adults being like, I saw you in the store. I saw you coming up the subway. Like, you know, for me, like, I think that was like my thing with God, just being like, okay, it's possible. Like my skin color really doesn't have to be the actual limitation to opportunities. And I just continue to really make that my mission just to increase that representation so that, you know, I want more people to see people that look like me to be out there so that young, you know, so they know like, wow, I saw so I can do that. Yeah.
I can do it,
you
know? Too.
So I'm like, you have to see it in order to be it. Cause otherwise if you don't, you'll think it's impossible. And for a moment I thought that was impossible. I was like, I'm not ever going to get anything because I mean, like you feel like you're up against such a big like obstacle. You're up against these big corporations that make these decisions and it takes one person, like it takes one company, one person to make that way for you. And when they did, I was like, oh, all right. Like I'm making my way. I'm going to keep going. And
you hear that, little black kids, you can be like Kamika too. billboards and representing companies. You are worthy. Don't let anyone make you think that you don't belong and that you're not good enough to get to that level, because you can. It'll be hard. There'll be obstacles in your way, but you can do it. So do it. Go for it. I love that.
Yeah, we should all definitely go for it. No, I was saying we should all definitely go for it. But you talked about the year of the Olympics is when you got the Hudson Bay. Do you think that that year, especially coming off a year of 2015, that you had a lot of pressure on you going into the Olympics? And what was the Olympic year going into Rio like?
I didn't really feel like pressure. No, like I felt like I was like, I'm ready to build.
Yeah,
like I was like, you know, I felt like 2015 was a great breakthrough year for me. So I was like, I want to just build for Rio, hoping that that was going to be my time. But 4 months before the Olympic trials, I had injured my knee. So I tore the cartilage in my knee and I missed 2.5 months because for a long period of time, we didn't know if I needed surgery. We didn't know, you know, how to go about it, if this was going to be like season ending. And we ended up, you know, figuring out the process. I did PRP and was able to get back, but I only had a month and a half before Olympic trials. So that was pressure. That part was pressure because, you know, I knew I wasn't in the best shape. I knew that I had the Olympic standard. I was national champion the year before. So all I had to do was come top three. Like, that's it. So for me, I didn't really want to put pressure of like, oh, I need to go in and defend my title, because I knew what I was up against and I was like, hey, you know what? I'm going to go in and give my best, but I know bare minimum, like I just want to be at that 100-meter line in Rio. Like that is my dream. So I knew I had to come top three and gave my best and I finished fourth. It was the worst possible position that I could have faced. Like I could have placed. It was a hard trials for me. You know, I think at that time, like I just wanted my moment to be like, yeah, I made the team. Like, you know, some people had their moments where it was like these were able to celebrate with the crowd and I'm over there distraught, devastated, you know, and I was like, it's done. Like it's over. It's done. Like I lost my opportunity. I still made the team for the 4x1 relay. But for me, I'm like, I don't want to go for the relay, man. Like, I was like, I was just fast as like, I was just like 100. Like, it was just so close for me. You know, and I had to check myself because I'm like, Kamika, like, what are you being ungrateful here? There's some people that didn't even make the team and you're really over here upset just because of this. But either way, like, I knew I still wanted to fight to try to get into the 100 because the two girls that placed ahead of me, they weren't going to compete in it. So we were appealing. We did the whole appealing process, denied. And I felt like that's when I was like, you know what, just let it go. Like it's done. So I was just training for the relay and I had to try to keep my hopes up. It was really hard, but I had to just really try to keep my motivation up because at the end of the day, my team would still need me there. So I still gave it my all in practice, even though like my heart was hurting. And one day I just got this call from the head coach and he was like, why are you appealing? You know, you have the Olympic standard, two girls are not running. Like we can put you in the 100. That's no problem, but you got to pass this fitness test. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like what's this fitness test? So at the Olympic, so in Rio at our camp, which is like, you know, we went like maybe 2 weeks before you actually go to the Olympic Village. They said that you would run a 80-meter time trial, electronic timing, and you had to run it in 9.10. So for me, to give perspective for people, my best is 11.13. So if I'm crossing in at 80 meters, 9.10 is almost equivalent to my personal best or faster.
Faster.
I'm not anywhere near my personal best right now. So, I was like, well, you know what? I'm gonna take the test. Like I'll do the test. And we just trained and I tried to prepare myself and I had two attempts. And, the first one, I absolutely blew it. I ran 9.20 and people think that's close, but it's not. Like, that's far off. Like, I'm a whole tenth off. Like, I was way off. And I just remember I just had this moment with God, and I was like, it just felt like nationals again. I felt all this pressure. And to even add on that, so Canada had to enter me in the 100, you know, and then if I didn't pass the test, they would just take me out. So back home, the media is like, yay, Kamika's in the 100. So they announced it. And so the media is going, yay, Kamika's in the 100. And everyone's like, yay, you're running the 100. And I didn't pass the test yet. So there was a lot of pressure. Like, all of that came back in. And, you know, I just had a moment of, like, not really focusing on the outcome of just, like, I just gave it all to God in that moment. And I was like, okay, well, let me just execute the best that I can. Like, let me not focus on, you know, the time. Let me just focus on how I can run this the best that I can and focus on the little things beforehand. So gave it all to God at that moment, and I ran, and it was 9.10 on the dot. So for me, you know, I didn't get my celebratory moment at nationals like other people did. You know, I had mine a week before the actual Olympic event, and I was by myself, just me and my coach. We were at the track. Everybody else was gone. And like, that was just my connecting moment with God of like, do you really trust me? And, you know, for me, I was like, just to pass that test and to have that moment just by myself, it meant more to me. And nobody was there to see it. Nobody knows about that story. When you see me at the 100 meter lineup, they just say, oh, okay, cool. She's there. She made it. Yay. But like, some people don't really know like the journey that it takes behind the scenes to actually get there. So I know that kind of meant a lot to me.
And not only the journey, but you mentioned pressure. And, you know, folks, I mean, for those who haven't competed in a stadium for a country, just think about pressure at work. You know, if you have something that's due that you have to do, and maybe your supervisor is expecting it, you just feel that pressure. Well, imagine, you know, your whole life you've been having the goal of going to the Olympics. And now that you're finally here, and your friends, your family, everyone in this country is in the newspapers, everyone you know, every teacher that you ever had, every principal, everybody, they're looking at this. And there's an announcement made that you are going to be able to compete. And you know that you have to pass a fitness test, and you might not be as fit as you want to be. That's, you know, the expectations of the country on your back. That's a big one that people don't realize. It's there. And, you know, athletes have to overcome that and deal with it and suck it up and push through and say, you know what, it's just part of the game.
Yeah,
but I still want to acknowledge it because it's amazing. You know, the stuff that people have to deal with.
I want to know. I want to know, what did you say to yourself? I know you talked that you had a conversation about everything, but what words did you say to yourself before that last
attempt? I better run fast.
Because I say a lot of stuff to myself when I'm getting online. I'd be like, listen, you need to get your shit together right now. So I want to know if you had one of those moments.
See, I was doing that when I was walking back. When they first told me, you know, coach said, "Bro, you know, you ran 9.20. I was like,
"Oh Lord."
Whoa. I popped out. Second run better be, you know, like, I can't let these people down again.
Nah.
But I don't know, to be honest, honestly, like, after I just had that little moment, like, I just looked up and I said, "God, I'm putting this on the altar." And honestly, like, I'm giving it to you. Like, at that point, I was like, clearly, you know, if it's not meant to be, if it's not a part of your will, then it's just not going to happen, and I'll be okay. Like, at that point, I had to accept, you know, that this may not happen, but I was like, I'm putting my all, like, my whole trust in you right now. And if it doesn't happen, I'll be okay. I know that wasn't meant for me at that time. And after that, I was like, just breathe, just calm everything down. And then, you know, for me, I just had to like just visualize how I wanted the run to be and like how smooth I wanted it to be. So at that point, I just had to like just focus and narrow in, not on, you know, the outside stuff, the outside noise, the noise of what the media could be saying if you didn't pass the test, or, you know, what you got to tell your friends and family if you didn't pass the test. Like, you're always going to have that battle of voices and thoughts of like, well, if it doesn't happen, this is like, that's going to be embarrassing. Like, I just had to tune all that out and just focus on what was right in front of me and give it my best. And that's it.
That's all you could do.
And it all worked out.
It did.
I just feel, because Rio, I was, you know, that for me was like a life goal, you know, mm-hmm. getting to the Rio Olympics. Even as a coach, it was just like, that was a goal that I had set. And I was, 2016 for me was great because it was like, I'm in Rio de Janeiro and I'm a head coach for a national team. So it was just like, you know, the double whammy. And it's funny, I had competed in 04, in 04 Olympics, but I mm-hmm. took it for granted. You know, I was mm-hmm. like eight, I was young. So I was like, oh, I'll get back here. And it, I did it. I didn't walk in opening ceremony. Everybody was mad at me. I just didn't know really what it was, I guess.
Yeah.
And so going back in 2016 for me, finally making it back there because I didn't get there in 08 or 2012. Mm-hmm. And so getting there as a coach, it was like, you know, just being in that opening ceremony, it was just extra special for me. So tell me about that, because I haven't asked anybody about their Olympic experience. You know, what was it like, that opening ceremony down there in the middle of the stadium? Did you walk in the opening ceremony or did you skip it like I did my first time?
I did not.
Oh, they chewed you out. Oh, yeah, they chewed you out, didn't they?
Yeah, they said, they did not allow us to go.
They didn't allow you to go?
Oh, they didn't allow you to go.
Yeah, no.
I was in Rio. I did qualify for Rio, and I was also the flag bearer. So I was at
That's right. That's right.
I was a flag bearer for my country.
I apologize. So sorry. I was the flag bearer. I remember you were.
That's a big deal.
I know.
Olympics. And for my first Olympics, that was a big deal for me to be chosen to carry the flag. And all I was thinking was, girl, do not drop this flag on TV. There was just like this little boy that was helping me. I was just like, don't drop this flag on this little boy. They're going to arrest you. And it was a good ceremony. I tried not to take for granted any of those moments. And as I go into my second Olympics, it is kind of like, I'm happy that I didn't take for granted because it's going to be so different this year. We probably won't have an opening ceremony where we could be among everyone and having that camaraderie. We can see hear the fans cheering, everything like that. We can be close to other teammates, all of that. We probably won't have that this year. And then so unlike you guys, I was happy that I took advantage of most of the opportunities.
Good guidance. So,
but yeah, Kamika said that they didn't allow her to go because it wasn't her fault. Would you have gone if you could have?
Yeah. I would have been like, where's my TV time? Just, you know, but yeah, they didn't. Our head coach like forbid all track athletes to go. He felt like it was too much to be on our feet. But
I'll say this about that. I thought that when I went in 04, I was like, being on my feet, I don't want to walk in this ceremony and I want to be fresh. And then I went out there and ran slow anyway. And so I just got in trouble for missing it. And it was like, this is the one, you don't know, you may never make it back to the Olympics. Like literally, what are the odds of making it to the Olympics? There's some ridiculous odds of going once. And then to just, you know, to not be able, that opening ceremony is electricity. You know, when you're in there and it's just all the countries and it's, you know, they have the torch. It's just like, man, this is something, you know, how many people get to experience that in person?
Mm-hmm. So and it's a moment of pride to be waving your flag up there. It's a moment of pride to be wearing your team colors, you know, representing that flag and knowing that you worked all your life to get this moment. Well, one of those moments, because that was just the opening ceremony. When you line up on the line, then you're like, okay, I dreamed for this.
Yeah. I would say next time when you make it, and I'm sure you're going to make it back, you know, you got to find a way to at least get in that ceremony. I know it's a couple days too close to your event, but it's, you know, you'll be 80 and you'll remember that. Did you get to the closing ceremony?
Yeah, we went to the closing ceremony. Okay, but it's not the same. Like, it's not the same. You know, it's not the same.
All the organizers are ready to go home.
Yeah.
They know. Yeah, like some people, like, you know, if you didn't compete, well, you're kind of like, you know, you're happy. But it's like, it's different. I don't know. Opening ceremonies, like, I remember Commonwealth, they said the same thing. You couldn't go. They told us that we have to go sit in the stands and watch it. And we tried to sneak in. Like, we legit tried, but... You know, they caught us and they're like, nope.
All right, Canada, don't get in trouble now. Y'all not getting this ceremony. And we start spreading this word because they can't take that away from people. It's like your dream to be in the Olympics when you're like 2 years old. Like that dream of Olympics is one of those early dreams. Like, I want to be in the Olympics. You see it on TV and they're like, I want to do that. You know, the fireworks and the You just like, yeah, I want to do that. And you're thinking about that when you're like 10. So when I'm, you know, you make it, you're like 20 and you're like, I'm here finally. My whole life has finally gotten me here. And they're like, no opening ceremony. Like, really?
I know. We watched it in the village. It was nice. Oh, man.
Yeah. Nah, I, you know, like I said, I missed it. I got chewed out. I thought I actually had a choice. They said, you have a choice. And then when I chose not to, everyone tore me apart.
Yeah. So now that Tokyo is coming up, how is the preparations going into that? How are your preparations? How are you feeling? You ready to go?
I've been feeling good. This is the healthiest that I've been. You know, I've had some years of injuries. So like, I feel like this is kind of COVID in some sort of weird way, it was a blessing in disguise for me. You know, the pandemic, quarantine, you know, I was dealing with an injury at the time and just trying to like overcome that injury when they announced the postponement and everything. So for me, like, it really gave me a lot of time to self-reflect, heal, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, like everything. So yeah, I don't know, like that. I know it was a hard time for a lot of people, but for me, like, I think I needed now. That time. Like, I needed you're ready it. Now, huh? Oh, really? Yeah, like I'm
you're not the first person I interviewed Bruno, the Spanish national record holder. I've been coaching him for a little bit. We were chatting about this, and he mm-hmm. said actually the pandemic for him was a time for him to refocus, kind of mm-hmm. line everything up, you know, heal, rest, mm-hmm. and kind of restart his plan. And he's in a great place right now. So, and I think a lot of athletes were in that same boat because folks are running fast. They are running mm-hmm. fast and throwing far and jumping high and far right now, just with 1 or 2 meets into the season. So mm-hmm. folks yeah. were using this time to get ready. And we're going to be following you. I'm looking forward to seeing what you do because we're speaking to Lashinda and she talked about her 08 Olympics and how she just felt like she fell short and she was so close. And she came back in 2012 and went ahead and got that silver medal and almost got the gold. So that's how it is when you kind of get there, but you just don't quite get it how you wanted it. So I want to see what you're going to do this time around.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it. What up? Before we let you go, I want to hear about outside of the track, the other things mm-hmm. that you do, because I'm sure you do. I always talk about how multifaceted our athletes are, and how smart they are, and how they're more than athletes, because people think that athletes are just athletes. Like, mm-hmm. all they can do is this one thing. Like, no, that person would have been good at pretty much anything they tried to do. They would have drive, and they would go at it like a maniac until they're the best. That's, you know, what's behind the whole athlete thing. So tell us more about what's going on outside the track for you.
Yeah. So as I said, the pandemic, it was a blessing in disguise for me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I realized that you had to find passions outside of track, you know, mm-hmm. like track cannot be, you know, if track disappears tomorrow, you got to still be okay. And for me, like, I was also thinking about, you know, I have Tokyo that's coming up, and maybe another Olympics. But after that, like, I got to start thinking about my transition. And, you know, with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, I felt like that really kind of just opened my eyes into things that I was really passionate about and things that drawing from my past experience of not fitting the look and, you know, just having those things of, man, I feel like my skin is limiting me from opportunities and how I want to help other people, young Black boys and young Black girls, to just be confident, have opportunities. And, you know, so for me, like, I was having a conversation with my friend and we decided, we're like, yo, let's start something, you know, like, let's do something. Like, we got to, like, we felt like there was this gap in the Black community, we wanted to help impact it. So we started Meet My Melanin. And yeah, I know, I came up with the name.
I was going to ask about that shirt. That's a dope shirt. Wearing this Meet My Melanin shirt. I love it.
Yes, Meet My Melanin. And basically, you know, we just want to talk about racial inclusion and we want to help the minority community to feel seen, heard, and known in all spaces. And we, for, you know, Black History Month, that's when we launched officially. And we already booked, you know, to be a part of a Black Future Speaker Series, and we were able to talk to schools across the board in Canada, just talking about our stories, our experiences. We want to amplify Black voices and share their stories and be able to like help educate about racial inclusion. And we were able to like impact those conversations in the classroom. So for us, like that was like a big thing, and just creating this community where we can inspire, share, heal together. And then just, you know, having those conversations and impacting those, the classrooms, the kids. So that's what we started. Yeah, I'm excited.
Nah, I love it. It sounds like you started during Black History Month, but you're going to make 2020 Black History Year. All year long. It's just that's all they're going to hear about. And I love it, you know, because, you know, representation does matter. And you know, I think the only people who feel like it doesn't are the ones who are overly represented, because they wouldn't see.
They see each other.
The impact, all the time. You know, there has to be some kind of luxury. I know it's privilege in being the default, you know, that you are what is supposed to be, and that the further away from what you are, that everyone else is, the stranger they are. You know, I think that's the whole mentality when you're not, you know, the standard image of what the best in Canada should look like. To me, you are what the best in Canada should look like. You do look like the fastest woman in Canada. So I don't, that never made much sense to me, but it is the world that we live in. And what you're doing is helping to break down those barriers, because regardless of what, you know, the folks outside of, you know, the folks outside who are looking outside in think, the ones who the message is meant for, the ones who need to see you out there representing them and showing them what they are capable of, that's who matters. That's who the message is for, and that's what's important. So despite what's going on, keep doing what you're doing, because it is having an impact. And some little girl is going to be the future fastest woman in Canada and out here, you know, making money, representing businesses and doing her and starting her own endeavors and taking over the world based off of what she saw, you know, you do. And so keep doing your thing. Definitely going to be following to see this next Olympics, because, you know, I want to see. I'm interested.
You know. Mika, tell our listeners how we can follow you and where we could get our Meet My Melanin shirt.
Oh, yeah. I want one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can get it on our website, meetmymelanin.com. The Instagram is also Meet My Melanin. And then for me personally, Kamika Bingham is a little too difficult. So my nickname is Bings. So you can just type in Bings, B-I-N-G-S on Instagram, and you'll see me pop up there.
Bings. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Definitely going to be following and subscribing and following the journey for sure.
Thank you.
Is there anything else before you go that you'd like to say to get out there to the folks?
Trust the process.
There's no pressure.
There's no pressure out here.
No pressure. No, this is an easy conversation. The folks listening are going to be completely understanding. So, you know. Trust the process, but that is a real one. When you make a plan and there's a process to the end goal, while you're in it, it can be easy to lose sight of that end goal, right? So like, you're like, man, I'm supposed to be doing this and I'm supposed to be running fast, but I feel terrible. You know, my legs are heavy. And so it's hard to see the end goal, but you gotta, like you just said, trust the process, because you made this plan for a reason. So no, that is excellent advice for folks to hear. Yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. And we're not going to forget you too, because I'm washed up, but Ashley is also training and competing and preparing for her next Olympics. So, you know, I will be following you as well.
I mean, you stuck with me for a little bit longer. So,
yeah.
you have a front seat to this.
I'm only washed up one here, the old one. So I don't know anymore, but I'm going to follow you guys and be cheering for sure.
All right. Well, Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for coming and sharing your story with us. And looking forward to staying in touch and continuing to follow you.
Yes. Thank you, Kamika, for joining our conversation. And continue to be relentless, you know, push through and trust the process. You'll be great this year.
That's right. Thanks. Do your thing.
You too.